This program, Is Anything More Important to Understand in the World Today Than Jihadism?, was recorded live on May 31st, 2006 at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, online at nysec.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society for Ethical Culture. My name is Pat Dubrovner. I'm the chair of the Society's Adult Education Committee, which planned this event. I take it everyone has turned their cell phones off? For those of you who may be new to the Society and may be wondering what ethical culture is all about, ethical culture is a humanist movement that was founded 130 years ago. It is inspired by the ideal that the supreme aim of human life is to work to create a more just and humane society. We're a fellowship of people who believe that we develop and define our character through the moral quality of our relationships with others. We try to act in such a way as to help bring out the best in each individual, and in so doing, we realize we'll be bringing out the best in ourselves as well. We believe that every person has the potential to grow in his or her ability to act responsibly, and that ethics involves a responsibility to the greater society in which we live and to the conditions that prevail in that society. The New York Society for Ethical Culture has been progressive, liberal, and proud of it from the very beginning. Among our outstanding accomplishments are the founding of the Visiting Nurse Service, the Ethical Culture Fieldston Schools. We joined with others to establish the NAACP, the ACLU, the Legal Aid Society, and the New York Committee to Abolish Capital Punishment. Our members have a long and proud tradition of advocacy on civil liberties and on human rights issues. As a community, we stand for the separation of church and state. We stand for a woman's right to choose. We stand against the death penalty. Membership at Ethical Culture is open to all who share our values. I invite you to get to know us better, to look at the table in the rear where there's information, although it looks to me like we've now removed the tables and filled it with people. But you can check out our website, which is nysec.org, N-Y-S-E-C.org. Among the commitments of ethical culture is our commitment to continually educate ourselves and others in ways that enable us to act more responsibly. Tonight's guest is Professor Fawaj A. Jejas, author of Journey of the Jihadist. Fawaj Jejas teaches at Sarah Lawrence College, where he holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in Middle Eastern Studies. He has also taught at Harvard and at Oxford. Fawaj is a senior analyst and regular commentator for ABC News and NPR's Morning Edition. Professor Jejas has a unique perspective. His quest to understand the modern Middle East springs from a personal source. His family's home was destroyed by factional fighting during the Lebanese Civil War. Our moderator tonight is Christopher Isham, who is the chief of investigative projects at ABC News. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Fawaj Jejas and Christopher Isham. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we should get on with it. And I would like to say that the book we're discussing tonight is the book that Fawaz has just recently, the book that has been written that we'll be discussing tonight is called Journey of the Jihadist. And it's inside the Muslim militancy. I think most of us are familiar with the repercussions and the events of modern terrorism over the last 20 years. But I think most of us are not familiar with the motives, what causes these events to happen, who does them, and why. And that's what we'll be discussing tonight. I'll talk to Fawaz for roughly 20, 25 minutes, and then I'll open up the floor to questions. And this session is on the record. So Fawaz, what is a jihadist? Who are they? What do they want? And what are they up to?
Thank you, Chris. Good evening. And I thank all of you really for taking the time from your busy schedule and coming here tonight. And I want to thank New York Society for Ethical Culture for hosting this wonderful event. Let me say a few words about the notion, the concept of a jihadist. I think in the American mind, as you know, since 9/11, when we say a jihadist or a militant, automatically we think of Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda has become synonymous with all militants, with all jihadists. This is, I mean, the conventional wisdom in the United States. In fact, I would go further, and I hope you take me to task after Chris and I complete our segment for saying so. Since 9/11, there is an industry of specialists on jihadists and militants in the United States and all over the world. Yet, as you know, and Chris, as you well know, the Al-Qaeda generation, the Al-Qaeda faction, is one of the smallest factions within the militant or the jihadist movement. What do I mean by that? And I'll try to go for the big point and say why it's essential to make distinctions and clarifications between Al-Qaeda and the other militants in the Arab and Muslim world. In the book, The Journey of the Jihadist, I follow the journey three generations. And long before, the term jihadism became a familiar household name in the United States since 9/11, I began research on this book really in 1998. I received a MacArthur Fellowship, and I spent 2 years working on this particular book. I came back home in 2000. Of course, I could not write the book after 9/11, really. I thought it was essential to wait a bit and see how the dust settles on the battlefield. But anyway, to answer Chris's question, I think I follow the journey three generations. The first generation is what I call the pioneers or the founding fathers of the jihadist movement. And this particular generation was born in the mid-1970s in Egyptian universities. This is one of the brightest generation in the Arab and Muslim world. It's a social movement. It was not born in the ghettos and the poverty belts of the Arab and Muslim world. It was born in the best social science and scientific departments in Arab and Muslim societies. And in the first chapter, I focus on the journey of one of the founding fathers of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Egyptian Islamic Jihad, for some of you who do not know the term, is the faction or party of Ayman Zawahiri. Ayman Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda's number two. And it was Kamal Habib. I focus on the character, the founding fathers of the first generation. His name is Kamal Habib. Graduated top in his class in Egyptian university, and I spent with him about 1 year and a half in Egypt, interviewing him in depth. And just to simplify here a great deal, because remember our time is limited, the first generation was middle upper class university graduates in the Arab and Muslim world. The primary target of the first generation, and the first generation represents the bulk of jihadists. Again, another clarification. At the height of its military power in the late 1990s, Al-Qaeda did not number more than 15,000 seasoned fighters. And this is according to, I think, even though you might say that about 40,000 fighters were trained in Al-Qaeda camps, Al-Qaeda membership did not exceed the 10 or 15,000 members. At the height of the war in Egypt in the late 1990s, Egyptian Islamic Jihad and Al-Gama'a al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group, which was, I mean, Kamal al-Habib, the first generation, was the founder of both movements, numbered over 100,000 fighters, just to show you the difference in terms of numbers between the two. Anyway, to keep the story short, the first generation of jihadists was defeated at the end of the 1990s. They were defeated in Egypt, in Algeria, and the bulk of the first generation basically conceded defeat. Here we come to the second generation, that is Al-Qaeda generation or the Afghan Arab generation. And ironically, between 1980 and 1990, 1991, the Afghan Arab or Al-Qaeda generation was in the same trenches as the United States of America. We are both fighting the evil empire, the Soviet Union, which invaded Afghanistan. In fact, it was not until 1991 that there was a break between the second generation, Al-Qaeda generation, and the West. It was after 1991 that the Al-Qaeda generation decided to target the far enemy being the United States and its allies, as opposed to targeting the near enemy being Arab and Muslim governments. Remember, the primary target of the first generation of the greatest number of jihadists has always been the near enemy, not the far enemy. And of course, it was 1991, and we know what happened in 1991. The United States intervened in the Gulf War in 1990-1991 to expel Iraqi troops from Kuwait. The United States decided to station troops permanently in Saudi Arabia being the birthplace of the Prophet Muhammad and the holiest two Islamic shrines in Mecca and Medina. Also, Afghanistan empowered and emboldened the second generation. I mean, as you well know, Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri, and the senior cohort said, well, look, if we could defeat the Soviet Union, the greatest military power in the world, we could easily defeat the United States of America. America was a paper tiger. Americans did not really have the nerves to fight. We could very easily take on the head of the snake. And I think the Afghan experience, coupled with the American military intervention in Saudi Arabia, were two decisive factors in shifting the jihad caravan from the near enemy into the far enemy. And finally, in the book, I follow the journey of the third generation and will say much about the third generation. That's what I call the Iraq generation. And we know very little about the third generation, even though I interview scores of militants who are making the journey into Iraq to fight the coalition forces and the Iraqi government. But, I mean, suffice it to say that the American-led invasion and occupation of Iraq has planted the seeds of the third generation. We are seeing the beginning of the birth of the third generation, even though we don't know much about the third generation. But those are, in really rough, simplistic, characteristic, the main three generations that have existed in the Arab and Muslim world from the mid-1970s until the present.
Well, I think that's a terrific kind of introduction and overview of the book and of Fawaz's perceptions on this. What I'd like to try to do is go back and deconstruct some of these generations. In your book, you talk a good deal about a poet, an Egyptian poet by the name of Said Qutb. Said Qutb came to America, actually spent a lot of time here, and wrote a book about America. And I think this book, which has had a formative influence on many Muslims today, I wonder if you could explain a little bit who he was, what the book was about, and his rather odd vision of America, very different from others, but I think it clearly had an impact on the view of many Muslims.
Thank you, Chris. I mean, Sayyid Qutb. Qutb is Q-U-T-B. If there is one person that has really inspired and motivated the militant or the jihadist movement is Sayyid Qutb. Sayyid Qutb is the philosopher of the jihadist movement. I'm sure most of you know that he was hanged in 1966 by the Nasser regime in Egypt because he was allegedly plotting to topple the secular Egyptian government in the mid-1960s. And ironically, Chris, Sayyid Qutb was hanged by the Egyptian government in 1966 the first jihadist cell to exist in the Arab and Muslim world, basically a month later after he was hanged, was established by Ayman Zawahiri. Ayman Zawahiri was a teenager at high school in Egypt, and in his book, Nights Under the Prophet's Banner, which was smuggled out of Afghanistan after 9/11, Ayman Zawahiri said that the hanging of Sayyid Qutb was one of the most pivotal experiences for him as a teenager. He decided to go underground and try to topple the Egyptian government. In fact, you cannot really understand the overall ideas and actions of the jihadist movement without understanding who is Sayyid Qutb, the ideas of Sayyid Qutb, and what Sayyid Qutb was all about. And ironically, again, Sayyid Qutb spent 2 years in the United States between 1948 and 1950, and his experience in the United States radicalized and militarized Sayyid Qutb against what he called the decadent Western culture. In fact, chapter 4 in my book, it's called The Great Satan, Near and Far. Not only I focus on the Islamist ideas of Sayyid Qutb, I focus on his journey to America and how Sayyid Qutb's journeys to America really brought about a dramatic transformation in both his character and his ideas. And I was able to track some of the letters that he sends to his friends while in the United States. And in fact, while he was in the United States, he developed the ideas that somehow there was an existential clash between the decadent secular Western culture, the liberal culture, and Islamic civilization. And he went back to Egypt and began to really elaborate on those ideas. And really, his writings on America have received, unfortunately, very little. I mean, some of them have not been translated, actually. But everywhere I went, in Egypt and the Arab world, Islamists and militants used to tell me, listen, you want to understand America, you read Sayyid Qutb. Sayyid Qutb knows America, knew America from within. And I think at the end of the day, I talked about the three generation of jihadists, the first and the second and the third, the Iraq generation. I think there is one overarching paradigm that unites all three generations, and that's, I think, their quest to topple the pro-secular existing order in the Arab and Muslim world and replace it with Islamic or entities. I think this was really the central fundamental idea of Sayyid Qutb. And I think what really the beauty about Sayyid Qutb, as you know, in Islam, I mean, in traditional classical texts in Islam, remember, there are many Islams. I mean, we keep speculating about Islam. We have to talk about the text, the readings of the text. Who are the reading the text? I think in Islam, there are two, it's called Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam. That is the abode of war, and there's the abode of peace. The house of Islam is the house of peace, and the house of war is that is the house, the outside the zone of Islam. I mean, I think traditional Islamists basically view the world in such, you might say, in a dichotomy, the house of Islam versus the house of war, which is a non-Islamic world. What Sayyid Qutb said, nonsense. This traditional dichotomy does not make sense anymore because the house of Islam is no longer the house of Islam, the house of peace. The house of Islam is the house of war itself. I mean, this was a revolutionary concept, Chris, because for the first time, here you have, I mean, Sayyid Qutb, he was a poet. He was not even a jurist or even an Islamic scholar. He said, the house of Islam, no longer, because now it's a decadent, it's a distorted, it's a secular, it's a non-Islamic house. And the first priority, he said, the first priority of all Muslim, of all activists, was to topple this particular decadent order and replace it with an Islamic one. And you cannot understand why all Islamists, in fact, I would say almost 95% of militants and jihadists, their primary focus is on the near enemy. The near enemy being the pro-Western secular governments that exist in that part of the world, because in Sayyid Qutb's terms, they are no longer Islamic. They are no longer Muslim. They are basically part of the house of the war. In fact, the far enemy, the United States, really is a secondary target. And let me go further, and I hope Chris will deconstruct what I would say now. In fact, the attacks on the 9/11, and this is what really I show in the book, where the United States was not the direct target on 9/11. The United States was indirect target. Remember, the basic fight, the fundamental, pivotal theater of operation is the Muslim world. But of course, as Ayman Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden argued in memos to their lieutenants in the 1990s, the only way for the jihadist movement to survive and become the vanguard of the Muslim Ummah is to basically attack the United States and force the head of the snake to lash out angrily against the Ummah. We will stand out, we will stand up and fight and become the vanguard of the Ummah. We will gain credibility in the eyes of the Ummah. Even in 1998, Ayman Zawahiri was telling his lieutenants, the only way for us to survive, to win the war inside the Muslim world, is to attack the United States and force the United States to lash out angrily against the Ummah. It's only then, and then, jihadists could basically gain credibility. And I'm quoting directly, we would gain credibility in the eyes of the Ummah, the Muslim community worldwide.
The fascinating thing about that, I think, is that the America and the Americans, I think, generally feel that we can seduce anybody, that our lifestyle and our cars and our women and our movies are basically... they basically can we can draw anybody in, and obviously we failed with Mr. Qutb.
Yes.
And to our detriment.
Actually, not only ironically, in one of his letters, when one of his letters to his friends while he was on the ship coming to America, and it's very difficult, he said, to show the decadency, how decadent American and Western culture. He said, on his first night on the ship, a blonde American woman tried to force herself on him. And he said, no, I mean, and I mean, this was...
Wrong blonde, obviously. We have to reassess.
But to show you that, I mean, to come back to Western blonde woman.
Okay. You also talk, I'd like to move on to your conversations, which were fascinating, with the Egyptian terrorist Kamal Habib, who was a part of your first generation. And what's fascinating about him is that he appears to have evolved in his thinking, in fact, turned against the concept of armed jihad. Who was he? What happened to him? He was very much a part of the movement of trying to bring down the Sadat government, the secular pan-Arabist government in favor of the Islamic government. He obviously went through a major change. That it was reflected with other Egyptian Islamists later on. But tell us about him.
Well, again, you might ask the question, thank you, Chris, you might say, why do we have to understand the cleavages, the tensions, the contradictions, the nuances among jihadists? Why do we care? I mean, because some of the narrative is they're all evildoers, that all jihadists are determined to attack the United States, attack Americans. That is the dominant narrative that has gained credibility in the United States after 9/11. If they are all evildoers, why really do we have to understand them? I mean, that's as simple. And I think what I try really, this book, and really this is not part of a debating point, this is not an argued book. This book is a book about voices. I let them really tell their story. I let them express their grievances, their biases, their prejudices. And I think it's really a humble effort at understanding, because we need to understand that shadowy universe that I think shattered America's peace of mind on 9/11. And ironically, the reason why I focus on the nuances and the complexities of militants, not because they have anything positive to say about America, but because the overwhelming number of jihadists are opposed to attacking the United States, the far enemy. In fact, by the end of the 1990s, the story of Kamal Habib, part of the first generation. Remember, almost the first generation represents about 95% of jihadists are part of the, first generation. They're focused on the near enemy. And I think Kamal's story reflects an overwhelming number of militants and jihadists who came to the conclusion that they could not really marshal adequate coercive power to topple the existing order. They were not transformed because of any intellectual quest. They were transformed because they lost the battle strategically in Egypt, in Algeria, in Saudi Arabia. They could not just defeat they could not defeat the near enemy, Arab and Muslim.
But they were
government.
Defeated by state repression.
Absolutely. I mean, decimated, really decimated. Kamal Habib he was sentenced to life in prison, spent 11 years. He has been arrested several times since he was released, tortured horribly. I mean, I mean, he and his colleagues, he was not the only one I interviewed. But I think what has happened, the point I'm trying to make here is that I think we make a horrible mistake by trying to lump all militants or jihadists together with Al-Qaeda. In fact, Al-Qaeda, as I tried to show in the book, September 11 was a disaster for Al-Qaeda because the bulk of militants, the bulk of the first generation of militants basically viewed 9/11 as a disaster. Kamal and others told me, they said, listen, we could not win the war against the near enemy. How could we take the war into American shores, the far enemy? Al-Qaeda unleashed the armada, the greatest power, and I flesh out all these ideas. 20 books have been published since 9/11, hundreds of articles by the first generation, who basically, in fact, what has happened since 9/11, in fact, there's a civil war raging within the jihadist movement, and this raises very important questions. If Al-Qaeda, Chris, if Al-Qaeda cannot represent, let alone speak for most of the militants or the jihadists, how can Al-Qaeda speak for the Ummah, the Muslim community worldwide? And in fact, part of the arguments, I mean, the argument has implications, even though I don't make the argument, because this is not a book. It's not an argued book. This is a book about voices. In fact, by 2002, Al-Qaeda was in a coma because it was crippled militarily, and also it was internally encircled.
Let's just sort of stick with Mr. Habib here. What was he trying to accomplish when he was in the trenches and involved in trying to bring down the Egyptian government? What did he actually want to accomplish? What was his goal?
Well, I think the point that he really made over and over again is that basically the existing secular order was basically an Islamic. I mean, time and again, he said he wanted to create an authentic Islamic order, that basically approximates the golden age of Prophet Muhammad and his four companions. That particular golden face, which really an ideal type, as you know, Muhammad and after Muhammad died, and there were four caliphate, centralized Islamic rulers who basically succeeded Muhammad. And that particular face it resonates deeply, and not only with militants and Islamists, but also with Muslims generally, particularly the first generation. They are addicted, they are obsessed with that particular golden face, that ideal face. And to his mind, the only way that the Ummah can recover its glory, the only way Muslims can really be, true Muslims, is to basically recreate that particular golden face that is during the Prophet Muhammad and his four companions. He wanted to create an Islamic state. He wanted basically to get rid of all the secular liberal tendencies that have fertilized Arab societies. He raged again and again against globalization. He talked a great deal about how Egyptian and Arab presidents basically were decadent. I mean, the story, it's amazing because I mean, some of us as, trained in the social sciences and humanities, we go to our thinking that socioeconomic factors and Marxist explanations really help us to understand why particular groups take up arms against societies. And time and again, when I press Kamal and his generation, tell me about where you came from. Why did you take arms against the state? And he kept coming back to me. Don't impose your Marxist terms on us. This is not truly, he lectured me consistently. We did not take arms, he said, because, wanted more bread on the table. We wanted better jobs. He said, we did not really endanger our lives because Kamal and his generation graduated top in their departments. They were really destined to be the leaders of their generations and their societies. And this moral quest, and I know it's very difficult for some of us, in particular historians and social scientists and sociologists, to understand that how insignificant socioeconomic factors are in motivating the first generation and how moral and doctrinal factors played a pivotal role.
And who would choose, just to ask mundane questions, who would choose the leaders of this idealized Islamic government?
And this is the question I focus a great deal. He kept saying, we did not take arms against the state in order to become leaders or rulers or have privileges. We want to establish committees made up of clerics like Sheikh Abd al-Rahman. As you know, Sheikh Abd al-Rahman, who is spending a life sentence in an American prison, was one of the most important leader in the movement itself. He also spent some time with Kamal and Ayman Zawahiri. And the idea was that al-Shabab in Arabic means young man, they would topple the existing pro-secular regimes, they would establish committees made of prominent, highly respected clerics like Sheikh Abd al-Rahman, who basically would govern in a collective leadership and would basically pass fatwas, interpret the Quran, interpret the Sunnah, because, of course, they stand against any kind of legislation because the Quran and the Sunnah are there. You don't need any legislation because they have everything.
So this would be essentially a dictatorship of the clerics?
Absolutely, even though he would say this is the ultimate form of democracy. Because to him, I mean, remember Sayyid Qutb, we come back to Sayyid Qutb, really.
But in which people have no say.
Absolutely, because... It's submission. If you submit the idea of submission to the ultimate, sunnah, that is the ultimate, way to live your life. When you live the godly life, when you connect as a believer, that is, to him, that's how he perceives. In fact, Western democracy goes against the very soul and heart of an Islamic democracy as he defines it and sees it.
But in your conversations with Habib, he seems to have understood that if they had succeeded, they would have created a nightmare state.
And that is really the most fascinating part about the soul-searching that's taking place within the first generation. I asked him the question, what if you had succeeded? And he said to me, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the actual words, he said to me, thank God we did not win the war against the near enemy because we would have recreated the same dictatorships that exist in the Arab and Muslim world. He said to me, we were not and we are not ready to create the institutions necessary. So even though, it's amazing even now how the first generation, how far it has really traveled, even though you might say they are still dedicated to really establishing Islamic states. But I think their Islamic vision now is much more complex, much more nuanced than the vision they had in the 1970s and 1990s. And in fact, it's ironically how the first generation of militants in Egypt, in Algeria, in Saudi Arabia, in Lebanon, in many places, they are really trying to create alliances with mainstream Islamists and even some nationalists who were their sworn enemies in the 1970s and 1980s. Let me put it this way. The scene is much more dynamic, is in flux than the conventional wisdom would have it. I'm not suggesting that those people would create any kind of a tolerant order if they won power, but I think they are really engaged. There is a great deal of soul-searching taking place, not only within the Islamist movement. Remember, the Islamists, we're talking here about the jihadist movement. The jihadist movement represents a tiny fraction within the Islamist movement. I would say that the mainstream Islamist movement in the upper 90s, while the jihadist movement represents about 2 or 3% of the Islamist movement. So we're talking about those radical activists who believe in the use, if the definition of a jihadist is the belief in the use of violence, of all means, including violence and terrorism, to topple the existing secular order and establish other autocracies or Islamic states.
I'd like to move on to your a little bit. There's a chapter in your book where you discuss your own personal experience growing up in Lebanon during the Civil War, in which really was the clash of civilizations, Lebanon having been a bridge between East and West for many years, the Christians and Muslims, the Shiites and Sunnis and Druze. of course, it all fell apart in 1975 and escalated and became a major a civil war which brought in the Israel and brought in the United States and brought in the Palestinians and resulted in a beginning of suicide bombings, etc. But tell us a little bit about your experience growing up, how you saw that beginning to fall apart, and how you saw those seams beginning to occur and those creases beginning to occur. Because I think it's interesting for people to understand your own perspective on that.
Well, you know, it's very difficult, really, to be a native and to write and to talk about the Middle East. This is really a very painful story. It's a painful story, and I really did not want to write this chapter. It was my editor, Tim Band. I don't know whether he's still here or not, who really nudged me to write this chapter. I think, and I really say it, and not being patronizing at all, since 9/11, there is a great deal of simplification when we talk about, the world of Islam. We try to lump not only all jihadists together, we lump jihadists with Islamists. In fact, some of us, we lump Islam with all Islamists and jihadists. We lump jihad with jihadists, even though... I think America was injured on 9/11, I think there is a great deal of pain, and legitimately so. But I can tell you, as a person, as a non-Muslim...
Probably a lot of Americans don't even realize that there are a lot of Christian
yes.
Arabs.
Yes. And I, not only, but the Jewish Arab community was a major community at one point. I was really, the reason why Lebanon, it's an important chapter in the book, because Lebanon as an idea, I went to schools where my friends were, I had Jewish friends, I had Druze friends, I had Muslim friends, I was born to a Christian family myself. This is really, Lebanon was an idea of coexistence, an idea where, so many ethnicities and cultures and points of views and tendencies existed in the 19, for centuries. And I think when the center fell in the mid-1970s, we tend to really lose sight of what happened in Lebanon between 1975 and 1990. As you know, a major civil war destroyed the country. More than 100,000 people were killed, almost 200,000 people injured. And I think when the center fell in Lebanon, I would say it was a watershed in the entire Arab and Muslim world. I think the idea of coexistence that Lebanon represented really, marked the beginning of the political disintegration, of the political turmoil in the entire region. Because I think the idea of coexistence that existed, of course, what happened, our small community, Jewish community, left. Many Christians, also immigration on huge scales. But I think more than that, not only the idea of coexistence, a deadly nail was hammered in this idea, because Lebanon really represented a model of that. I think the whole notion, the idea of, Chris and I were talking earlier, the idea of suicide bombings, it was born on the Lebanese battlefield. As you know, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and of course the birth and the rise of Hezbollah as a militant movement. It was really Hezbollah that basically pioneered the art of suicide bombings. And as Chris said, not only in a tactical form, but also in a strategic way, that the use of suicide bombings in order to expel, what they call foreign occupiers, whether it was the Israeli army or even the American military presence. As you know, the United States intervened in 1982 to help calm the situation, basically because the Israeli army was in Lebanon and there was a civil war in Lebanon, and the Americans decided to really send a contingent of troops to basically bring about some order into Lebanon. And I think what happened to the American Marines. Some of the most devastating suicide bombings took place in 1982 and 1983 and since then. So I think the chapter on Lebanon not only really, tells the story from the beginning, but also I think it tells the story of the rise of this mindset, of this ideological mindset that uses, suicide bombings as a strategic tool in the service of politics. And I think there's the story of Lebanon is, and I hope that it basically engenders a debate.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Lebanon was that it was always a model of tolerance and openness in which different communities could exchange views and coexist and go to work and work together and live together without friction. And then, of course, that all collapsed in 1975. Tell us, I think the story that you tell about your own village and how you saw that evolve, I think, is quite instructive as well. I wonder if you could relate that story.
As you know, many massacres were committed in Lebanon. I mean, all of us, really. My family was no exception. I mean, I think it was a very brutal chapter. Basically, Christians massacred Muslims, and Muslims massacred Christians. It was tit for tat, I mean, on large scales. Tens of thousands of people were massacred. I mean, I was born and I lived in a small village in northern Lebanon. And the village existed peacefully with its Muslim neighbors for centuries. I mean, remember, it's the old world. Truly, as I suggested earlier, I had friends, all kinds of friends, all ethnicities. On that fateful morning, I mean, in 1975, fanatical bands of militants, Muslim militants, invaded the village at 3 in the morning and basically burned and killed. The whole village was destroyed. I mean, we became refugees overnight. But even though you might say, and this is, the tragic and the story, even though that bands of fanatical Muslims invaded and burned our village, it was our Muslim neighbors who helped us the morning after, who sheltered us, who took us to their homes, who really, and I think what the reason why this is an important story, because it's essential for us not to really generalize about communities, about cultures, about civilizations. I think I would argue that it was a tiny minority of our neighbors who came and burned and killed, basically my neighbors and my relatives and my uncles and my friends. But I think the larger community was appalled by what happened. And even though, remember that Christians also, some fanatical Christians attacked and massacred and burned villages on the Muslim side. And in fact, it was this tit for tat that basically inaugurated a horrible chapter, not just in Lebanon, but in the entire Middle East. And I think for some of us who lived through such brutal chapters, I think we have a kind of a complex understanding of violence and terrorism, and the notion is that essential not to really lump people together, not to distort the humanity, not to dehumanize others, but rather to have distinctions and to call things by their name.
As you mentioned before, out of this civil war was born the modern jihadist model. Which was on April 18th, 1983. I remember because I was there. A truck drove into the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. And at that time, of course, there were no cement barriers because it had never happened before. It was the first time. And a truck drove right into the lobby and killed more than 100 Americans. The entire embassy was brought down.
238 Americans.
And the entire CIA station of the entire area was destroyed, and the entire embassy, of course, was brought down like a house of cards. And it was a devastating blow. And to be followed in October of 1983 by the bombing of the Marine compound, which killed 243 Marines, as I recall, and, of course, the French compound as well, which were also in there. And this resulted in what they called at that time the redeployment of the U.S. forces off the shore of Lebanon, which was a misnomer for withdrawal. So I think what was interesting about that, I think, is another one of those critical seminal events in modern history of the modern Middle East and history of terrorism, because it provided a model for bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the subsequent generations in several ways. Number one, it provided a model that should show that these kind of events could do enormous casualties, enormous amount of damage, and produce horror, and literally terror. And that was the objective, and they accomplished it, and they accomplished it quite successfully. And then they also accomplished very, very specific strategic objectives. In this case, get the United States out and the multinational forces out of Lebanon. And, of course, it succeeded in doing that. And we were gone by February of 1984, as I recall. So what do you think was the lesson derived from that by the Islamists? What was the import of that?
Great question. I mean, I think there are several questions Chris put on the table. I think the first question is that, and again, I flesh out in the chapter, in chapter two, how Hezbollah and the pro-Iranian elements in Lebanon use suicide bombings as a strategic weapon against both the Israeli army and the American and the European forces that they were stationed in Lebanon. I mean, it was not a theoretical question. They were fully aware, and I talk about some of the statements, some of the press conferences made by some of the bombers and their helpers. And this brings me to the second element here. As you know, since 9/11, we have talked a great deal about Salafism. And I know Chris is, I'm sure he has a question for me about Salafism. As you know, Salafism or Wahhabism, you've heard the term Wahhabism. Salafism slash Wahhabism is a form, a conservative Islamic interpretation of the texts, and basically it's an ideology born in Saudi Arabia and the so-called Wahhabism. I mean, this is a Sunni Islamic construct. But the irony is, it was not Sunni Salafism Wahhabism that pioneered the art of suicide bombings. It was pro-Iranian Shiism that basically pioneered the art of suicide bombings. And this is really one of the lessons that we don't remember because we have short memories. We talk about Salafism, Wahhabism, and fanaticism and suicide bombings as if somehow that Salafism is a unique construct, that there is something unique about Salafism. Yet the art of suicide bombings was really pioneered by the pro-Iranian militant Shia tendencies. And Lebanon became, a major theater for that particular, and long before Osama bin Laden was really thinking about the use of suicide bombing or Ayman Zawahiri. And just to say a word about Salafism, Salafism is a highly provincial, Islamic tendency. It really focuses more on rituals. It focuses on how women should dress, whether women should go out of the house. It focuses on daily rituals, what Muslims should do on a daily basis. What has happened to Salafism, Wahhabism in the last 10 years or so, it's the what I call the marriage between Saudi Wahhabism and Salafism with Egyptian radicalization. That is, you cannot understand how Salafism was transformed in the valleys and wadis and mountains in Afghanistan without understanding the influence of Sayyid Qutb. That is, the influence of Ayman Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda number two, on the Salafi ideas of Osama bin Laden, and long before that, the influence of the pro-Iranian Shiite militant ideas on both Ayman Zawahiri and the jihadists. By the way, I talked about Sayyid Qutb, and I hope I did not mislead you. Sayyid Qutb never advocated or called for the use of terrorism. Never. I mean, we call Sayyid Qutb a radical Islamist thinker, but openly, he never called or promoted the use of force or violence in the service of politics, even though he called on young Muslims to rise up against the oppressive, secular, pro-Western decadent order in the region.
I'd like to pick up on the notion of Wahhabism and Salafism. this is a strain of Islam, of Sunni Islam, that as you said, has very specific and very rigid views, but seems to have been appeal
Yes.
To many people involved in terrorism and jihadism, whatever you want to call it, that seem to be inclined to deploy violence in achieving their goals. What is it about this aspect of Sunni Islam that appears to lend itself to support or authorize or give permission to this kind of activity, which kills completely innocent people? And is this something that is unique to this particular strain of Islam, or is there something about Islam itself, and I think this is really important, that lends itself to authorizing this kind of terrorism in which completely innocent people are killed?
Well, I mean, thank you, Chris, for your blunt question. I mean, the question has to be put on the table. I mean, there are several points, and let's have give and take on it, because I think there is no one definite answer on this question. I think one clarification: the overwhelming majority of victims of terrorism are Muslims. Please understand this, that you have since 1981, since the first generation decided to take arms against Anwar Sadat, they killed him in 1981. More than 250,000 Muslims have been killed as a result of this particular confrontation, even though that thousands of Americans have been killed since the mid-1990s. And I think I would say that
I think the question here is a deliberate...
Absolutely.
Deliberate killing of non-combatants, which is very different from collateral damage, the kind of things that happen in warfare.
I'm coming to your question, really, because I'm making some clarification to... really, if you read, the text, if you read the Quran, it's amazing. You have... Unlike Christianity, in Islam, you have such a systemic set of rules and limits in the conduct of war. Basically, Islamic texts tell you exactly whether women can be killed, whether the elderly can be killed, whether religious people can be killed or not. And this is even a tree in Islam. Even a tree is sacred. You don't destroy a tree because a tree is part of the environment. It's fascinating to me. It's a magnificent... Here you have... I know it's very... Because, since 9/11, again, the notion is that Islam, there's something, a rotten gene out there. The notion is... And the rotten gene has to be plucked out. Even though we wrap the notion is that Islam is a peaceful religion, but, the conversation is loaded. There is something about Islam, not just, Salafism. But the truth is, if you look at the text, at the Islamic text... They have specific rules on how war should be conducted. Have Salafists and jihadists used Islam and manipulated Islam in the service of their politics? Yes, absolutely. Is there something about Salafism that basically legitimizes the use of violence and terrorism against civilians? We know, yes, absolutely. But what's irony, and this is the nuance I really tried to put on the table a while ago, is that Salafism is apolitical. Classical Salafi Wahhabi strain of ideology is really apolitical. It became politicized during the Afghan war as a result of the interaction, the fertilization between the Salafi reactionary conservative tendency of Osama bin Laden and his cohorts and the radical contingent, Egyptian contingents of Sayyid Qutb. And we cannot understand why Salafi jihadis now use violence on such huge scales without understanding what I suggested to you, and I would be delighted to clarify, the fertilization, the marriage, the interaction between Saudi Wahhabism and Salafism and the Qutbist idea of radicalization, which, let's remember here, Osama bin Laden in the 1990s, in the early 1990s, was one of the most vocal anti-suicide bombings against the near enemy.